understand me. I do want to make a brief comment at the outset. I feel somewhat out of place at a conference devoted to psychoanalytical aspects of Wagner's music. I am neither a psychologist nor a psychoanalyst and find it problematical when colleagues, musicological colleagues, arbitrarily apply their own subjective psychological insights to the life or work of a composer. I naturally don't mean professional psychoanalysts. But it seems to me to be a mere demonstration of power for an author to apply his or her knowledge to a person or a work without taking into consideration the whole work, including the music, or the whole life of the artist. As an example, I would like to mention an article by Elizabeth Bronfen, a colleague whom I otherwise very much admire. In her analysis of Parsifal, she expands certain terms such as trauma and hysteria so that the actions of all the characters are interpreted as nothing more than hysterical behavior. Parsifal's cry, "Die Wunde," after Kundry's kiss, is depicted by her as the identification with the wound of the other as a mimetic representation of the wounds of Christ. Quotation end. But turning Parsifal or Amfortas into a hysteric does not get us anywhere. If we interpret the actions of all the characters as hysterical behavior, we run the danger of turning the concept itself into something vacuous. I prefer Dorothea Wegepenning's opinion, who in her essay, Salome und ihre Schwestern, Salome and her sisters, analyzes figures such as Mona Lisa in the opera by Max von Schillings, Mariette from Korngold's Die Tote Stadt, or Prokofiev's Renata, all of them hysterical figures on stage. She writes, "All this has hardly anything to do with women. They are projections by men, perverse yet bourgeois, inhibited yet lecherous, fearful male fantasies. In other words, they are all about male hysteria or schizophrenia, which are here personified in female form." James McGlathery writes in his book, Wagner's Opera and Desire, "Desire and its effects clearly remain Wagner's focus of poetic interest." And he continues, "It is hardly going too far to conclude that Wagner's operas are largely dramas of incestuous feelings and urges. He is convinced that Wagner is mainly concerned with erotic passion. As we all know, Wagner's works can be regarded from various angles and deal with many different issues. I would, however, agree with McGlathery in that desire and its effects are a major topic, and I would like to demonstrate this by using Kundry as an example. It is important to realize that desire was an emotion that in Wagner's times could only be freely displayed by men. After the Enlightenment, with its strict polarization of gender roles after 1790, women were not allowed to show open desire. They were forced to stay passive. In an attempt to find a logical reason for Wagner's wish to create a woman such as Kundry, who is punished for showing desire, I believe we can achieve our goal by considering Wagner's life, his writings, and his music altogether. We can hereby minimize the danger of reaching forced conclusions because there has hardly ever been a composer as prolific as he. We have an enormous number of his letters, thousands of letters, statements, diary entries, Cosima's diaries, Mein Leben, his autobiography, and essays with which to work, along with his operatic oeuvre itself. However, as we know, he can often send us down the wrong path as he was not always truthful, so one has to be very careful. An important clue can be found in Wagner's relationships with women. His letters show that he was completely unable to live without a female partner, unlike composers such as Beethoven, Bruckner, or Brahms, and others. I realized this for the first time when writing a biography of Minna Wagner, his first wife. While dictating Mein Leben to Cosima, when he was very critical of Minna, of course, but the letters that he wrote when he was married to her paint a quite different picture. He was absolutely dependent on her and even threatened to commit suicide if she left him. When he escaped to Switzerland from Dresden after the revolution of 1849, Minna refused for several months to follow him there, at which he sent letter after letter in great agitation, until he had to realize at long last that she did not love him unconditionally anymore. This was unbearable to him, and so he fell in love with Jessie Rousseau shortly after. When that went wrong, he fell in love with Mathilde Wiesendonck, that was 1852, and this relationship turned out to be the most important of his life. Mathilde was young, rich, intelligent, and beautiful. She saw herself as his pupil and wanted to learn from him. She is connected with Tristan and Isolde, as you know, but many people do not know that Wagner was already madly in love with her when writing the Walküre. He wrote 17 abbreviations on the sketch of the first act of the Walküre, can be seen in the archive in Bayreuth, such as O-W-I-D-L, which one can easily decipher as O wie ich dich liebe, oh how I love you, and the others are quite similar. As we know, this first act shows the gradual development of mutual love, which is something unique in this whole oeuvre. And I think the fact that seven of these 17 letters, abbreviations he writes over the sketch of the first act, all have to do with Siegmund and Sieglinde looking at one another, which very often goes through the first act. And we know that he often sat in the house of Mathilde and Otto Wiesendonck and read out parts of his work. And the only possibility he had of contacting Mathilde was through looking at her. So we find it in his work. But not only Die Walküre is connected with Mathilde Wiesendonck. Wagner changed the plot of The Meistersinger after seeing Mathilde and Otto Wiesendonck in Venice in 1861, when he realized how impossible it was to continue hoping that she might leave her husband to join him instead. He had an awful time in Venice with the couple. He probably heard that she was pregnant again, and that also, depressed him. And he wrote to her shortly afterwards, "Life and everything to do with it has no meaning for me anymore. Where and how? It is completely pointless to me." Quotation end. Such despair is dangerous for creative people, as it disturbs the creative part spark that is the fundamental essence of their life. But however miserable Wagner might become, he always found a way out. In spite of his misery, he started working on his 16-year-old sketch of the Meistersinger and suddenly hit on a superb idea that could help him to cope with his own situation. He added the love of Eva for Hans Sachs. He wrote to Mathilde, "The old sketch offered little or nothing. You have to have been in paradise in order to know at last what can be found in it." Quotation end. In his letters, he makes it clear that paradise for him was being loved by Mathilde. It was against this background that Sachs's character had to be redrawn. And as you know, he gives up all hopes of ever having Eva and gives her just to another man, and he's an ideal person, an ideal character in the opera, whom one has to love. 4 years later, Wagner wrote with hindsight that he had sketched the work in order to save myself from a miserable world of experiences. This is a further reference to the fact that the urge to complete the opera was less a result of external factors than of inner motivation. Schopenhauer's philosophy helped Wagner to cope with his frustrating love affair. He wrote, "Schopenhauer's principal idea, the final denial of the will to live, is of terrible seriousness, but uniquely redeeming. When I think back on the storms that have buffeted my heart and on its convulsive efforts to cling to some hope in life, I have now found a sedative which has finally helped me to sleep at night." Simon Williams writes that Wagner found Schopenhauer's philosophy to have an oddly tonic effect on him. This idea of giving up hope helped Wagner in his relationship with Mathilde, not only by adding something to the Meistersinger, but also in writing Parsifal. Parsifal also has a lot to do with Mathilde alongside the other operas, as I mentioned. Wagner started thinking intensely about this opera while he was writing his diary that was meant for Mathilde. He was still trying to find a way in which to cope with his loss of her. I believe that the destruction of the unbridled woman in Parsifal is not derived from any traditional cultural fantasy, but was a result of Wagner's personal situation. His unfulfilled love and the great emotional turbulence he endured from 1859 to 65 led him to desire freedom from his compulsive dependence on women. He wanted to retain an interpretive monopoly and no longer to suffer pain because of women. The first time that Wagner mentioned Parsifal to Mathilde was back in 1858, when he still lived next door to her villa and they saw one another daily. He writes, "Shall we see one another today?" and adds a melody with the text, "Where can I find you, Holy Grail? My heart, full of desire, is searching for you." Quotation end. Mathilde is at this stage the Holy Grail, and Wagner is both celebrating his desire to see her and at the same time assuring her that he will not touch her as she is holy. Not long after, he writes to her, "The enormous fights we managed to win, how could they end except with a victory over every wish and desire?" Quotation end. He had to quench his sexual desire, and this cost him much suffering that only abated when he adopted Schopenhauer's theories. He writes long passages about having compassion midline, which must be seen in connection with the weeks and months of his own suffering, Leiden. He manages to sublimate his own suffering and to protect it as compassion. In March 1859, during a period of emotional turbulence, he writes to Mathilde, "Parsifal kept me really busy. His plans for the opera thrive during this difficult time." We know that Wagner thoroughly appropriated Schopenhauer's ideas. The ethics of compassion, the denial of the will, the rejection of the sexual urge, the conviction that Christianity and Judaism are fundamentally different, and finally his praise of asceticism, are indeed derived from Schopenhauer's thought. I believe that he wove these ideas into a narrative that was of direct concern to himself. Wagner was a master of eclecticism, taking and using whatever suited him. He was immediately able to enthuse about a writer, but his own creative work was always at the heart of his concerns. Gradually, Wagner had to comprehend that he had no realistic chance to win Mathilde as a lover, so he searched for alternatives. He stopped working on the opera, for between his love for Mathilde and his relationship with Cosima von Bülow, he was without a proper partner. He took any woman he could, such as his household help in Vienna, Maria Völkel, whom he tried to convince to move to Munich with him, but she obviously refused. She was his so-called best treasure. The milliner Bertha Goldwag was ordered to Penzing and requested to sew several elegant women's negligees for her. In Vienna, he also became acquainted with Seraphine Morrow, and they too soon became intimate. Indignant that moral grounds prevented his black-haired doll, as he called her, from moving in with him, he wrote to his colleague Peter Cornelius, "I would find nothing wrong if the girl came to me and were to me just what she can be with her pretty little nature. But how to find the terminus socialis for it?" When writing to Mathilde Wiesendonck, he naturally chose a different tone. But his despair was no less real for it. And he writes to her, "It is not meant for me to nourish my muse in the bosom of cozy domesticity. Every endeavour to fulfil this great desire on my part and defy the ill will of my fate is ever more emphatically thwarted from within and without." He then asked Mathilde Meyer to live with him. She refused, as she was a middle-class lady and could not live with a married man. He had a short affair with the actress Friederike Meyer and probably with his maid Vreneli. He reported to Mathilde Meyer that Vreneli was devoted to him like a little dog, and added a sentence that Mathilde blacked out, unfortunately. She also cut out the letter so that we can assume that he told her about his affair with the maid. Then at last, Cosima von Bülow came to Munich and he started this love affair with her. This occupied him to the end of his life. She remained a godsend to him. With increasing age, his fear grew of being left alone and he often had terrible dreams that Cosima would leave. The longer they were together, however, the more irritable Wagner became. While this may have been a result of his physical deterioration, it also took on inexplicable dimensions. Cosima, after all, had made it possible for him to complete The Ring and Parsifal. To this end, she sacrificed her reputation, her marriage, and all emotional independence, making herself the ideal wife of whom Wagner had always dreamed. Why, then, did Wagner devote himself to Parsifal, an opera from which women are thoroughly excluded, when he was so dependent on them? It took many years before he was able to complete it. 20 years after making the first prose sketch, which is unfortunately no longer extant, he took up the subject once more and made a prose draft of the libretto. According to Egon Voss, Richard felt remorse for the manifold acts of betrayal that he was committing. He had cheated his friend von Bülow, and he was both lying to King Ludwig and to Minna, to whom he was still married. The feelings of guilt, so Voss believes, made Wagner no longer a Tristan but an Amfortas, who has to be redeemed by Parsifal. I find this theory a little far-fetched, but nevertheless interesting, as Egon Voss is one of the few to bring together Wagner's life and his work. I'd like to go back for a moment to the beginning of his work on the opera. He was madly in love with Mathilde Wiesentonck, yet he found no fulfillment. So he read Schopenhauer and put up with the fact that he had to love her without consummating his passion. I now jump to the year 1869. Siegfried was born, and a year later, Cosima wrote in her diary, "All the passion of love has gone. It still exists for Richard." A day later, she stressed this by writing, "I think I'd be ready for the convent now." Cosima obviously derived no enjoyment from sex, and this encroached on Wagner's own sexual desire and probably even spoiled the sex act for him. As we know, Wagner flirted with a beautiful French woman, Judith Gautier, but gave up immediately after Cosima noticed. On no account did he want to endanger his relationship to Cosima, for her commitment was of vital importance to him. Once again, Richard found a solution to deal with her sexual abstinence, namely by fantasizing a world in which women play no importance, the world of the Knights of the Grail. Although Parsifal was initially conceived to celebrate the purity of his relationship with Mathilde Wiesentonck, so I think, it turned into something that goes further than just praising asceticism. In addition, Wagner shows us a man's world in which women are practically non-existent. Kundry has to die, and with her all the erotic magnetism of women disappears. Only the flower maidens are left, but they are harmless. Wagner speaks of their childlike naivety, which had to be wholly divorced from any element of sensual seduction. He saw the flower maidens as tree plants. It was this idea, he told Cosima, that had inspired him for the melody of their chorus. He means here the beguiling Kampfgolder Knabe with its mock oriental ornaments. These 12 intertwined voices with their chromatically descending melodies to the accompaniment of the harp convey an ecstatic sensual impression, whereas the simple triple time and the straightforward harmonies symbolize the playful simplicity of these blood plants. "We don't play for gold, we play for love," they sing. And as they try to ensnare Parsifal, they beg him, "Let me blossom for you. Lovely boy, my loving travails are for your pleasure and balm." They squabble over him. Each of them wants to kiss his mouth, cool his brow, and stroke his teeth. His cheek, sorry. This is a male wishful fantasy because the women here are harmless and cannot ensnare the man. What a ridiculous picture of women this is. An artifact of nature, half prostitute, half plant. They have clearly no will of their own. Wagner here follows the tradition of seeing woman as nature, whereas man is spiritual. I must say I feel indignant as a feminist, but even non-feminists must see that this is a thoroughly unfair picture of the sexes. As to the opera itself, there are three different approaches to women in the opera. One is Parsifal's love for his mother. The second, the pure sexual enjoyment that the harmless flower maidens have to offer. The third is Kundry, who displays a detrimental sexuality that can lead men into spiritual death if they agree to it. We already find such a dialectic of eros and asceticism in Tannhäuser, but Kundry unites them here. She is Elizabeth and Venus in one person. Kundry, this puzzling, complex character, was a blank space that Wagner filled with all the traits associated with woman at the time. She is maternal but also cursed, a courtesan, a penitent, a witch, a seductress, a corrupter, the devil's bride, an ecstatic fury, and an avenger. She seems to have more in common with predatory women like Delilah and her later successors, Tuwandot, Salome, and Electra, than with the religiosity of Parsifal, where the music is otherwise treated as a means of consecration. Kundry practically forces herself on Parsifal. In our Western society, female sexuality is regarded as more threatening when women are seen to be actively seductive. She possesses an autonomous sexuality and makes demands on men, all very dangerous. This type of woman is doomed to die in our cultural artifacts, as does Kundry. Parsifal is granted the opportunity to develop from a clueless youth into the anointed king of the Grail, whereas Kundry functions only as Klingsor's tool. Parsifal is a messianic hero, the absolute opposite to Kundry. Wagner is driven by his tendency to view the world as a product of dualistic conflicts, Jew versus Christian, good versus bad, spirituality versus sexuality, and woman versus man. Even as a naive fool, Parsifal is something special, and this fact is made evident from the beginning. His motive is played by horns and bassoons, with its dotted rhythm, its triplet, and its ascending upbeat fourth. It reminds us of military marches. For instance, Robert Schumann has it in his album For the Young, in the Soldier's March. In the course of the action, Wagner gives his principal character a potential for development that is expressed in music throughout the opera. His noble motive is triadic and ascends at the beginning, whereas Kundry's chromatic motive shoots downwards and thus right from the beginning, promises ill, or augurs ill. As Hans-Joachim Bauer has written, diatonicism has long expressed the beginnings of things, that which is closer to all origins and is harmonically purer and is related to the realm of the divine, whereas chromaticism, which belongs to Kundry, signifies all kinds of ills such as guilt and sin. These two worlds are clear in the music. The orchestral prelude to the drama begins with a noble-sounding communion motive in unison in the strings. This is then expanded upon by trombones and trumpets, and the opening bars end with the ethereal sound of flutes. The impression of dignity is continued by the Grail motive in character akin to a chorale, which is solemnly intoned by the brass and punctuated by mighty pauses. I think I'll leave the musical description to just carry on, as we don't have so much time. In contrast to this, the world of Kundry and Klingsor is depicted with all possible musical signifiers of evil. When Kundry is announced in the first act, a harsh dissonant chord is heard, and the tritone, the classical interval of fear and conflict, is heard 10 times, one after another. What is conspicuous about her theme is a feature that dominates almost all tragic, desperate, and conflict-ridden situations, namely the diminished seventh chord cascading downwards fortissimo over more than 4 octaves. Despite minor variants and shortenings, it is never substantially altered, as are other motifs of the opera. Kundry is not capable of development, not musically developed, and I think also as being. It is noteworthy that the so-called Klingsor motive is also assigned to her. Already in the first act, before Klingsor ever appears, it sounds several times in connection with her. She is thus closely allied to Klingsor. In her dramatic depiction too, Kundry comes across in negative fashion. She rides, hurtles, lurches, drags herself along, or twists violently on the ground. She is full of raging turmoil, is dressed in snake skins, and has a dark brown-red skin, which points to her foreignness. When she is not engaged in excessive motion, she lies frozen and lifeless on the ground as if she were dead. Wagner employs manifold musical means in order to create shrill, harried sounds for her appearance. Her vocal line is marked by extreme intervallic leaps and rhythmic disjointedness. The sounds she utters range from a primal scream to anxious whimpering. These are stage directions. She utters a hideous cry and howls of lamentation. She sings coarsely and abruptly, etc. All this is reminiscent of Wagner's fateful article, Jewishness in Music, where he registered his displeasure at the supposed spluttering, shrill, buzzing, grunting sounds with which the Jewish manner of speaking expresses itself. Both woman and Jewishness are hereby subjected to an aggressive act of exclusion. When Kundry reaches her attempt at seduction, we hear the Kundry motive and the magic motive 6 times within the first 50 bars, which we can interpret as hysterical repetitions of a magic spell portraying Kundry's character. Often both motives are used together. I'll leave the rest out. The fact that Amfortas's suffering was caused through sexuality and that his knights live in celibacy is hardly mentioned in the sources that Wagner used. Whereas in Wagner's sources, namely Chrétien de Troyes and Wolfram von Eschenbach, Parsifal is transformed into a wise man during the course of the narrative, Wagner concentrates the moment of recognition on the kiss of woman. Parsifal achieves his development leap by rejecting Kundry. What was supposedly a yearning for love was thus really sexual desire and nothing else. In his libretto, Wagner lists numerous terms with negative sexual connotations. We read of evil desire, the horrors of hell, temptation, corruption, the hellish urge of the most terrible desires, addiction to sin, and so on. The contrasts are striking between the feminine world of kings or Kundry and the flower maidens and the masculine world of the Grail. The asceticism of the elite male order stands in opposition to female sexuality, and the flower maidens are depicted as prostitutes. The Christian Western world of the Grail, a world of the spirit, is contrasted with the exotic Arabian world of the senses, in which lurk demonic sexual urges and ultimate perdition. Holiness, purity, and immortality attained by viewing the Grail are reserved for men. Kundry has no access to the Grail, so she must die, just as the flower maidens must wither away. These differences are highly audible in the music. Diatonicism and a lack of ornamentation express the simplicity and nobility that are characteristics of the hero and leader, while the depravity of the sensual world is expressed by means of chromatism and lavish ornamentation. In this opera, we are taught that sexuality is a sin. We heard that in the other paper. It has corrupted the brotherhood, it forces Klingsor to castrate himself, and it nearly corrupts Parsifal. The male brotherhood concerns itself with spiritual, intellectual matters, and is contrasted with the woman driven by her urges, whose behavior is animalistic. She is a being of nature and not of culture. Despite her endeavors to find balsam to heal Amfortas's wound, the music shows Kundry as a destabilizing person. I'll leave that away too. And now I would like to here to return to my thesis that Wagner's work was strongly influenced by his life experiences. In 1852, he confessed to Liszt that he had married Minna at a very early age and that she was unable to follow him completely. I'll just quote what he writes to Liszt because I think it's important. "To be sure, I lived into my 36th year before becoming aware of that terrible emptiness," he means in 1849 when Minna left him, refused to leave Dresden to join him in Zurich. "Until then, my being was preserved by the balance of 2 battling elements of desire within me, of which the one I sought to quench through my art, while periodically giving vent to the other through lustful, fantastical, sensual excess." And he puts in brackets, "you know my Tannhäuser, this idealization of what in reality is so often trivial conduct. And then, perhaps in Lohengrin, I got a feeling for the knowledge of the unity of these 2 currents in true love, the love that I was only to know in yearning, not in experience. God, how I would gladly have fled naked into the world to be nothing, nothing more than a man happily loving and loved. My dear Liz, since then, art has really only been a matter of secondary importance to me. It is merely a remedy to me and my need, nothing else. Yet it is ultimately repeatedly becoming a true remedy in need, for need compels me to help myself through my art in order to be able to live. And yet it is only in true desperation that I take up my art time and again. When this happens, if once more I have to renounce reality, then I have to plunge again into the surging sea of artistic imagination in order to find satisfaction in an imagined world. In her study of Kundry, Chikako Kitagawa writes that the notion of her wildness is founded in aspects of the subconscious and the instinctual. She believes that in this character, Wagner thematizes deep layers of the human psyche and thereby points into the future, anticipating modernity. But Kitagawa stops here. I would take this further and say that hysteria is not a real phenomenon, but a construct or projection surface for male fears and desires. In this sense, Kundry becomes a subversive figure who lays bare male hysteria and unsettles the patriarchal order. Wagner's attempt at the radical elimination of female sexuality in a cultural fantasy actually makes the precise opposite visible, namely the heavy dependence of man on woman. Dependence brings out aggression, and in the almost otherworldly sounds that Wagner evokes, I believe the dream of a sublimated exclusion of women, and above all, of her desires. Wagner here meets Sigmund Freud. In his book Civilization and Its Discontents, Freud claims that the constitution of society requires a suppression of individual instincts, Triebe. Sexuality is one of these main instincts that is regarded as one of the most dangerous, for it can lead to chaos. Because it is suppressed, it leads a vital, chaotic life in the subconscious. Whereas Freud points to the subconscious, Wagner tries to create a life without that level. But his description of Kundry in the first act shows that he grasps the fact that something exists along the lines of a subconscious level. Everything about Kundry is costume, he said to Cosima, the ugliness, the beauty, everything is a mask. The music of Parsifal, and I come to the end, captivates and bewitches us by its beauty. I think this is something we have to deal with. I find the plot sometimes awful, but the music is so magnificent, we have to live with these contradictions. The message that the opera conveys, however, is a continuation of polarity mapped onto gender. Men stand for rationality, Kundry for chaos. With Parsifal, Wagner wanted to cast off the power that women held over him. And yet he yearned for eroticism and sexuality. For him, eroticism was a source of life. Indeed, it was the fundamental requirement of his creativity. Even those unwilling to acknowledge the prominent role that sexuality plays in his opera texts would at least have to recognize the fervent erotic power of his music. I'm thinking of Tristan Isolde, where he even goes so far as to describe an orgasm in music in the Liebestod at the close. Although I have no real knowledge of psychoanalytical theory, I can perhaps close by suggesting that in its efforts to kill off woman and sexuality, this opera demonstrates exactly the opposite. It situates sexuality in the subconscious and thus makes it visible. I would like to end my paper with a poem that Mathilde Wiesendonck wrote and, as Julius Kapp states, dedicated to Wagner, which can be found in the town archive of Zurich. I hit upon it and I'm absolutely certain she can only have meant herself and Wagner. She went over probably in her nightdress to his little house next door and wanted to sleep with him. And the translation is a bit clumsy, but I'll just read the first words in German and the rest in English. Habe oft dich bitten wollen um den höchsten Augenblick, doch ein unerklärlich Bangen schaudernd hielt das Wort zurück. I often wanted to ask you for the most exalted moment, Mathilde writes, but an inexplicable anxiety, shuddering, held back the word. I wanted to follow my inclination just once, to be blessed just once, to take pleasure in the whole fullness of the highest earthly joys just once. And so I took heart, crept at night to your door, knowing that it was unlocked. I wanted to hide from you in there. When I reached the steps, a noise made me stop, and I saw a female figure pacing along the corridor. It was Minna, of course. She softly turned the handle of your door and flitted inside. Soon after, your footsteps echoed and the door was bolted. Unheard of agony stirred within me. All my emotions churned and the beat of my heart, stricken at its source, faltered. It lay upon me, leaden like lead, and I knew no more salvation, and I writhed on the ground, wincing with pain, turning back and forth. And then the song of the harpist sounded from the little roof beneath the roof, from the little room beneath the roof, and I fell at his feet and remained awake all night in misery. In this poem, Matilda shows us how something similar to hysterical convulsions can truly develop. She says she was lying on the ground and writhing with pain, turning back and forth. And how painful this ascetic relationship was to both her and Richard. In his opera, Parsifal, Richard frees both Matilda and himself from this pain, while at the same time showing us how elemental is sexuality to quality of life and happiness. Thank you.